I'd like to welcome everyone to another episode of Two Men in the Bible, Fighting the Cosmic Battle. My name's Jamie Sanchez, and again, I'm joined by Pastor Bob Brandon.
Hi, Jamie.
How are you?
I'm good. You're always get a little tired about this time of night on a Sunday, you know, the end of the week. It's 7 at night, the sun's setting over our beautiful valley, but this always charges me up. So absolutely. 1 minute ago, I was tired. Now I'm wide awake.
Now it's time to go. So, we're into Numbers. We talked last week about what really, you know, the text is going to talk about.
That's right. Do you remember that the basic outline of this book, there's really two halves, though it's not equal halves, but there's one clear division. The first 25 chapters are about the generation that left Egypt, that group of people. The second half, you know, starting in chapter 26, is about the next generation, because every one of those original generation guys died in the wilderness, except two, the two spies that said, no, we can take this land. And so God brought them into the land, but everybody else died. So the book splits easily into those two halves. And the way you know that the text is itself being demarcated that way is it begins with a census. And that's what we read last week. Chapter 26 begins with a census. And it's the count of the new generation. And the purpose of that is to divide the book in two. And it even says in the text, you know, none of those guys survived. And there's, except those two that we mentioned. So there's a reason for that. So anyway, that's the text of the book. And we titled it, remember, there's a book of Numbers, and then the Hebrew title is In the Wilderness. And our summary statement of this book, just like Leviticus was Meet Dad, right? The book of Numbers is the geography of nowhere.
You're right.
It's like, oh, we are. I like the Hebrew title, you know, In the Wilderness. And there's not a person listening to this that hasn't spent a significant portion of their life metaphorically in the wilderness. In fact, many of us are there right now. And to get to the end of the story, before we even begin chapter 2, here's how you get out of the wilderness. Obey your way out. You're not going to find a way out. You just have to obey your way out.
Well, which is kind of what led them into the wilderness, right? Was there lack of obedience?
Well, I don't know if I'd say it that way, because that was the plan. You know, you got to go through this area to get from Egypt into the promised land. So it could have been through the wilderness instead of in the wilderness.
Well, it could have been like through there in a couple of years rather than 40.
Yeah, not even. A couple months.
Right.
It's not going to take long. That geography is all compacted over there. They're not going a huge distance. It's not like you could be there tomorrow, but they could easily make that journey a couple weeks, a couple months at the most, and 40 years is a long time.
Well, and that obey word, Bob, I think...
That four-letter word?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, that I've had conversations with, that's almost that's a deal-breaker.
For some people, it is. It is until you realize, you know, like we talked in church this morning, it is futile and ultimately fatal to resist God's plan, because that is going to happen, and it'll run you over if you get in the way of it. So obedience in light of who God is and what he's laid out makes perfect sense. Obedience to a non-perfect authority, you know, there's times where you got to fudge on that.
Sure.
Not with the Lord.
Right.
So that's how the book as a whole shapes up. Why don't we begin reading chapter 2? And here's a little heads up. We, for the first time, I believe, in the biblical text, summarized some passages instead of reading it word for word. I want to make that same caveat tonight as we do chapter 2 and maybe even chapters 3 and 4 on this same podcast. Any reader who's not just listening along with us but also reading will understand why we're doing this. We don't mean any, even in the smallest sense, disrespect for the Word of God. Every jot and tittle is inspired. But you'll see why we're doing that in certain of these passages. So how about if we start out and we may jump some things. Okay? Here's Numbers chapter 2. Now, the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, "The sons of Israel shall camp, each by his own standard, with the banners of their fathers' households. They shall camp around the tent of meeting at a distance. Now, those who camp on the east side, toward the sunrise, shall be of the standard of the camp of Judah by their armies. And the leader of the sons of Judah, Nashon, the son of Amminadab, and his army, even their numbered men, 74,600. Verse 5. Those who camp next to him shall be the tribe of Issachar." Okay, let's pause. And then he goes through the list. Okay? what he's doing is giving geographical map kind of references to how they're going to move through the wilderness. So the tent of meeting, you know, imagine the tabernacle in the middle of the camp of Israel. We're talking about a couple million people. And in the middle, you got this big old tent. And by the way, a pillar of cloud by day, fire by night. I mean, God's in your midst. And he's telling them, line up this way. And imagine trying to organize a couple million people. If I get more than five, I just start, God, I can't keep control of this. You know, it's too much. A couple million, and you've got to organize them and so on. So they go by tribes. Judah's listed first. It begins with the east. Remember, everything's always towards the east, going back to the earliest chapters of Genesis. So Judah has the pride of place here, clearly. I mean, they're the leaders. And so the tribes on the east, we're skipping over the passages now, but this is the content that's in them. The tribe Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun all go in the east. Opposite of them, so on the north, is Benjamin, Manasseh, and Ephraim. Or, excuse me, Naphtali, Asher, and Dan. To the south, Reuben, Simeon, Gad. Back in the west, Benjamin, Manasseh, Ephraim. So that's how the tribes line up, as they're very organized moving through the wilderness. So with that in mind, let's go towards the end of the chapter. Okay, verse 32 of chapter 2. Reads like this: "These are the numbered men of the sons of Israel by their fathers' households. The total of the numbered men of the camps by their armies, 603,550." That's the fight. That's how many guys they could put in the field.
That's fighting men.
Fighting men. The Levites, however, see, that's not the whole population at all. The Levites, see, they haven't even been counted yet. However, were not numbered among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Thus the sons of Israel did, according to all that the Lord commanded Moses. So they camped by their standards, so they set out, everyone by his family, according to his father's household. So that's chapter 2. The Levites are kept aside. They're going to take up the next two chapters. So we'll be reading about them shortly. They function as the priests of the nation. So a couple points to bring out to our listeners is essentially the role we're trying to play with the podcast is we're reading coaches, right? That's what we're teaching people to do, to read the words of God. So some of the takeaways from a chapter like that are, number one, they're doing everything just like God said. Right? It says in verse 34, "Thus the sons of Israel did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses." So at this point, it's perfect obedience, but here's my own take on it, so feel free to punt. Big deal. How hard is it to do something? You know, you guys go stand over there. That's not that hard, right? That's not a thing deep in your heart. You know what I mean? That's organization. That's okay. Right. We need external order. When you get into some of the other commands, they're going to drop the ball big time. At this point, the easy outward things are being done very well. The reason I mention that is that's not uncommon in the Christian faith either. It isn't that hard to get up on Sunday and, quote, go to church and sit there and, you know, you did your thing. So, I'm not against that. I'm all for that. I wish more people would do it, but big deal. That's like on a scale of 1 to 100, that's a 1.
Yeah, you still have Monday through Saturday.
Yeah, and it's good that you got the 1, but that's very little, right? So they're obedient here, but it's not a huge kind of obedience, you know?
Well, and even if we look at our culture today, I mean, how many times are things even put in front of that?
I've got something going on this week.
Oh, and I can't go to church. I got something else going on.
Yeah, I'm tired. You know, last night I got carried away, and I got it. That's right. You know, the other takeaway, though, I don't want to go too far down that path. Mm-hmm. I think everybody realizes that, but is did it surprise you that Judah was first?
No.
Why?
Well, because I know the rest of the story. Okay.
That's a great answer. That's right, because we know the rest of it, so we nod our head. But that is a little bit of an eye-opener. How did Judah, by this time in the story, already achieve prominence? I mean, what do they got going on that's a little different? Because if I had to pick anybody, I might pick Ephraim, right? He's from Joseph. Joseph, of the 12 tribes, was the guy that stood out to me. Well, a couple things. Number one, both in the book of Genesis, remember when the brothers, the nice, kindly, gentle siblings, like all of our siblings growing up, wanted to kill Joseph and were really close to doing that. Do you remember somebody saying, don't do that?
Yeah, it was that Judah?
So if you go back and look in Genesis chapter 37 where the brothers sell Joseph into slavery, it's first Reuben, the firstborn, that says, hey, I don't think we should kill him. And then Judah says the same thing over in verse 26. But he also provides a means of escape. Maybe not the greatest means that anybody ever hoped to. I mean, being sold into slavery isn't that great, but you got Judah getting his nose in there saying, you know, don't do this.
Right.
Here's another way. So at that point, he's starting to show signs of leadership. But then when you get to the end of Genesis and Jacob, you know, with his last words is blessing his children. And he goes on and on over Judah.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that early, God was saying, you know, this is the guy. So, by the time you get into Numbers, he's already the prominent tribe. And then, as you said, the rest of the story, he very much, you know, Jesus is from the tribe of Judah. David's from Judah, right? Those are the gigantic heroes. But here's the point. Here's the takeaway from this chapter. Judah was not the firstborn.
Reuben was, right?
Reuben was. So, I guess here's how I would say it. Much like a game of cards, you know, whether it's bridge or what have you, the cards you get dealt are not necessarily determinative of your future. It's how you play those cards.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter what your past is, that can be changed. The past does not have to be a binding factor in your life. You can be set free from the past. You just obey your way into the future, and God will bless you.
You know, I think that needs to be a bumper sticker, Bob. Obey your way.
Obey your way into the future. Forget the past. Obey your way forward. That's
like
how
it.
We're going to get out of the wilderness.
I like it.
So honestly, that's chapter two in a nutshell, which is really all we have to do for that. So let's move on to chapter three and chapter four, and actually we can do these two chapters almost as quickly. Let me read the initial few verses and you'll get the flow of it. Now, these are the records of the generations of Aaron and Moses at the time the Lord spoke with Moses on Mount Sinai. These then are the names of the sons of Aaron: Nadab, the firstborn, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the anointed priests, whom he ordained to serve as priests. But Nadab and Abihu died before the Lord when they offered strange fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai. They had no children. So Eleazar and Ithamar served as priests in the lifetime of their father Aaron. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Bring the tribe of Levi near. Set them before Aaron the priest, that they may serve him. They shall perform the duties for him and for the whole congregation before the tent of meeting to do the service of the tabernacle. They shall also keep all the furnishings of the tent of meeting along with the duties of the sons of Israel to do the service of the tabernacle. You shall thus give the Levites to Aaron and to his sons. They are wholly given to him from among the sons of Israel. You shall appoint Aaron and his sons that they may keep their priesthood. But the layman who comes near shall be put to death." Right, the tent, right? Don't be going in the tent without... Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Now behold, I have taken the Levites from among the sons of Israel instead of every firstborn, the first issue of the womb among the sons of Israel. So the Levites shall be mine. For all the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified to myself all the firstborn in Israel. From man to beast, they shall be mine. I am the Lord." Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, saying, "Number the sons of Levi by their fathers' households, by their families. Every male from a month old and upward you shall number." So Moses numbered them according to the word of the Lord, just as he had been commanded. These men are the sons of Levi by their names: Gershon and Kohath and Merari. Okay, now we get in a big long list of, okay, here's all the descendants. So why are they counting the Levites?
I don't know why they're counting them. I understand why they're setting them apart, but I don't understand why necessarily they're part of the census.
Okay, well, it's said in the text. We're coaching here.
There to perform duties for him and for the whole community.
What belongs to God? What did the text say?
I mean, just first directly. Sons. First sons.
The first
firstborn.
So if there's this many people in the nation, you got to have X number of Levites to account for the firstborn in every family. So they're going to be comparing numbers here, and it's not going to come out exactly even. And so God's going to say, all right, then here's what we do in lieu of the numbers aren't quite even yet. So you guys owe this amount of money, and we'll get to that passage, until everybody's accounted for. This is very specific about what belongs particularly to him. The reason I'm putting that in a caveat fashion, like what particularly belongs to him, everything belongs to him, right? But some things are specifically set aside directly to him, like the firstborn. So that's what he's doing here. That's how serious he is about that issue.
So it's going to be it's going to be equal, you know, one
yeah,
for
that's
one.
Right. That's right.
Kind of a one for one.
Yeah, all
measure.
Going back to the Exodus, you know, this is what I established at that point, right? Remember the text, if you can remember back that far, going over even Pharaoh's son dying. And at that point, Pharaoh lets him go.
Pharaoh knew at that
yeah,
point.
And it's like, you know, sorry you had to give up the life. You know, you could have realized this a long time ago, Pharaoh. But that's how serious God is about stuff that belongs to him. So what would that be And I'm asking this in an open-ended way. What would that be in our lives? What really does belong to him in a way that you're not even just steward of it, like we're steward of all things God gives us, but what specifically belongs to him?
I would, you know, my first inclination would be our heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I'm not saying that like I have an answer for that. I'm just posing it to each person to think through.
Yeah, I would have to say, you know, the heart. That's what really belongs to him.
Okay. So then, Jamie, we're gonna gloss over some verses because what the following verses do is detail the families of the Levites and assign duties. You know, this group takes the poles and so on. This group takes the utensils. This group takes the curtains and stuff like that. So we offer that to everybody to read it. We'll pick up the text in verse 39 of chapter 3. All the numbered men of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron numbered at the command of the Lord by their families, every male from a month old and upward, were 22,000. Now the Lord said to Moses, number every firstborn male of the sons of Israel from a month old and upward, and make a list of their names. So count every firstborn. We got 22,000 Levites. Now count every firstborn in the whole nation.
Males.
Yep. That's right. You shall take the Levites for me. I am the Lord. Instead of all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites, instead of all the firstborn among the cattle of the sons of Israel, everything that's firstborn, right? Every living thing that's firstborn. So Moses numbered all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded him. And all the firstborn males, by the number of names, from a month old and upward, for their numbered men were 22,273.
Oops.
So we're 273 guys short on the Levite side. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites, and the Levites shall be mine. I am the Lord. For the ransom of the 273 of the firstborn of the sons of Israel, who are in excess beyond the Levites, you shall take 5 shekels apiece per head. You shall take them in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel is 20 gerahs. They're just standardizing the payment. And give the money, the ransom of those who are in excess among them, to Aaron and to his sons. So Moses took the ransom money from those who were in excess, beyond those ransomed by the Levites. From the firstborn of the sons of Israel, he took the money in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary, 1,365. Then Moses gave the ransom money to Aaron and to his sons at the command of the Lord, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So that's chapter 3. Any thoughts on that?
Who paid the money? The family of the firstborn?
I guess everybody is kind of pitching in, because how could you determine, oh, my firstborn guy was accounted for, but yours wasn't?
Right.
It's just a gross number. So I think they're taking this from the people at large. So,
okay.
And maybe by tribe. You know, this tribe owes this tribe this much, and so on. Now, hearken back to this, though. How did these guys have any money? I mean, they were slaves in Egypt.
Well,
this is a decent chunk of change.
The Egyptians gave them everything on their
way
out.
You remember that from when we read through that story. The Egyptians loaded them down with money, clothing, other stuff they had. And at that time, Egypt as a nation was fabulously wealthy. Fabulously so.
As a result of that?
No, Egypt, it's mostly...
I'm sorry. I thought you said Israel.
Egypt was...
Yeah.
You know, even if you've seen anything like come through your town, like King Tut's, you know, funeral stuff, Tut was a blip.
Right.
He was no famous king. He was nothing. It's all gold.
It's all
right?
They had.
I mean, they were so wealthy. We told the story earlier, even, 1,400 years later with Cleopatra and Caesar. And Caesar's died, and now Cleo's trying to get a deal done with Rome, and she's out on her barge on the Mediterranean with Antony, who's going to fight Octavian, who becomes Augustus. And she's trying to seal a deal with Antony, and they're eating off these golden plates and stuff, and she just throws it overboard when she's done eating. And Antony's like, "Whoa, what are you doing?" And she says, "You know, this is nothing to us. That's how much gold we have." So Egypt was fabulously wealthy. So Israel started off pretty good.
Well, and if we look at this, I've got this picture, Bob, in my mind. All these people, we're talking about 1 million plus people.
2 million, probably.
And
it's got to be. If you have 600 fighting men,
right?
You can 600,000 that you can put in the field. You got more than 2 million.
And you're looking at it, and you know, from Moses' standpoint, you know, I'm looking at this valley. I mean, that would fill up my view.
Yeah, as we look and out that way.
That's and they don't have any loudspeakers or anything like that. Somehow, the message needs to get around, and they all need to adhere.
That's right. Yeah, they're doing it through chain of command. You know, the heads of the households come here, and Moses will tell them, and they'll go back and tell everybody. That's right.
And they're being obedient.
To this point. Okay, Jamie, so let's move on to chapter 4, and likewise, we can get through this one fairly quickly. Again, it's not our goal to move quickly, it's just the nature of this kind of material you can move quickly through. So chapter 4, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, "Take a census of the descendants of Kohath." He's right, the Levites really break into three families, Kohath, Merari, and Gershon. So these are the Levites. "Take a census of the descendants of Kohath from among the sons of Levi by their families, by their fathers' households, from 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, all who entered the service to do the work in the tent of meeting. This is the work of the descendants of Kohath in the tent of meeting concerning the most holy things. When the camp sets out..." Okay, remember the tabernacle, and then the tribes are arranged east, west, north, south, and the Levites are surrounding that inner circle right around the tent. No one's allowed in there lest the Levites give the say-so, and so on. So for Kohath and all those descendants, they're concerning the most holy things, verse 5, "When the camp sets out, Aaron and his sons shall go in, and they shall take down the veil of the screen and cover the ark of the testimony with it. And they shall lay a covering of porpoise skin on it." They had really cool stuff in there.
Specifically porpoise skin.
Yeah. Yeah. And although we think it's that, but let me pause here just by way of general information for the readers and our listeners. When you see a word in ancient Hebrew like walk, you know what that means, walk. Okay, you're going to see that word 1,000 times. Any word that's common, we have a very good idea what the definition of that is. Certain animals are not common to us.
Right.
And so you'll see a word, and it'll be in a context such that you know he's talking about an animal, but you don't know what. There's some kind of bird, you know, that we don't have here. You don't know what it is. So some of those highly specific words are hard to define. I think this is probably porpoise skin, just like it says. But it could be some other sea creature, a seal or something. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. The best guess is probably porpoise skin. But where else are you going to read that?
Right.
Okay,
right.
So it's a very specific term. We don't have enough data to be too precise on all that stuff. So probably is a porpoise. verse 6, "And they shall lay a covering of porpoise skin on it and shall spread over it a cloth of pure blue." and shall insert its poles. I mean, don't have the idea that this thing was, this tent, the tabernacle, was, you know, like an army, you know, like a camouflage thing. Boring, mm-hmm. trying to hide in, you know, fit in with the wilderness. It was brilliant, right? Remember reading some of those descriptions, right. Like the scarlet, the blue, the purple. Mm-hmm. It was magnificent. I mean, you'd be impressed if you saw that thing. You would say, that's who lives in that tent,
right?
See that fireball over there?
That guy.
So, verse 8, they shall spread over them a cloth of scarlet material, and cover the same with a covering of porpoise skin, and they shall insert its poles. Then they shall take a blue cloth and cover the lampstand for the light, along with its lamps and its snuffers and its trays and all its oil vessels by which they serve it. And they shall put it and all its utensils in a covering of porpoise skin and shall put it on the carrying bars. I'm almost certain part of the purpose is it's waterproof.
Right.
Right? The porpoise skin. Even though they're going into the desert. I mean, it's not a ton of rain there, but from time to time. So, and then the chapter just continues on. Here's the responsibilities of these different groups with these certain items. So the specificity with which God wants his tent handled is very detailed, right? Be precise about these things. So let's pause there. We'll pick up the text a little bit later in chapter 4. But let's draw out a principle just from that. You know, oftentimes, Jamie, we've painted the picture. You know, imagine you're sitting on this big old chair in your living room. It's big enough for two. And God's sitting there. And you're sitting in his lap. His arms are around you. And the book's in front of you. He's holding the book open in front of you. And he's reading the Bible to you.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
And then you just sit there and turn around, you know, Dad, what were you talking about here? Mm-hmm. Imagine asking that for this chapter.
Would love
to. Dad, what's the deal? And, you know, he smiles on you because you asked in a good way. You know, he smiles on you. And what would he say? How would you fill it in? The specificity with which he wants his stuff handled is remarkable in its detail. Mm-hmm. So let's principalize that. How specific is the gospel message?
Very.
See, I think so. And mm-hmm. I think if you mess with that, he's like, because it is so in our face in our culture that we are to tolerate everybody's ideas. And I am just adamantly opposed to that. I'm all for freedom of religion. I'm not saying that. But the ability to declare which one is right, I mean, I think, you know, like recently, again, this will date to our podcast. You know, years from now, we'll come back to this and go, oh, I remember when that was. Because you remember this week, another mass murdering thing, right? This guy in Wisconsin goes into a Sikh temple. Now, I don't know a ton about the Sikhs, but I know it's not the Christian gospel message.
Right.
So it's wrong. Do I think those guys should get killed for that?
No.
That is abhorrent to me that someone, you know, went in there and did that. So I am all for freedom of religion. I'm just also all for freedom of saying which one's right and which one isn't.
Freedom of truth.
That's right. So we're taking that from the principle that, you know, handle my stuff correctly. So today, we don't have a temple, right? That, like they did, the physical structure. Actually, we do have a temple. It's our bodies, right? Mm-hmm. As Paul will speak about in Corinthians, we're the temple of the Lord. So even there, handle that really carefully. How you handle your own material body is very important to him as a Christian. You are the temple of the Lord, right? Say, this will ruffle some feathers. So all those guys who get tattoos, You don't want to be tattooing the temple of God.
That'd be like spraying graffiti.
I just say it that as simply as I can. Mm-hmm. Not a good idea. Okay? But second, again, since we don't have the physical temple with us now, there is one in heaven. But to me, the Bible itself, you know, performs a lot of those functions. It is where you meet with God, right? These mm-hmm. words aren't just words on a page. They're living and active. Don't tamper with the words. You know, you decide what you want to do with them, but don't change them. Treat them as holy.
Right.
That's some of the principles I would draw from a chapter like this. So the text all the way through verse 48 is very similar to what we've read already. The details of how to handle the specifics of the tabernacle are recorded there. So we encourage everybody to read that, and then we'll just read the last verse of chapter 4. According to the commandment of the Lord, through Moses they were numbered, everyone, by his serving or carrying. Thus, these were his numbered men, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So the same type of refrain at the end of that chapter. They're doing exactly what God says at this point. But again, it's mechanical. You know, you guys carry the bowls. Okay. Right? That's not necessarily going to reflect your heart somewhat. Though it does, to some extent. I don't want to rob them of their obedience. It was good at this point, but it was the easy stuff. It's mechanically easy to do that. But still important to God. I mean, he's saying do it this way, and they are. So they're getting started on. Okay, now, let's see if we can get one more chapter in on this podcast. It won't take too long, but we have to set the table a little bit for this one. To some extent, the numbering of things is going to take a pause. Now we're going to get a chapter on a different subject. We're not going to be counting how many people and so on. We got something else going on. So, again, it's not dark yet, and we can still look out the window, and Jamie's house sits up on a mountainside. And so as we look out our bay window here, we're looking down a valley. Big mountains on the right, big mountains on the left. And we're seeing the far west end of the Vail Valley. It's wide at this point. It really narrows as you go 30 miles down the road into the village of Vail, where it's very tight.
Definitely.
But regardless, so we're looking out down this valley, and we're imagining 2 million people walking down that valley. And they would take most of it, right, from where we sit, that would fill our vision at this mm-hmm. point. And we have a panoramic vision here.
Oh, it would definitely.
And that would fill a lot of what we would be looking at. Now, as they start moving forward, do you imagine that conglomeration of 2 million people? And let's say it this way. When I go to work, one of the things you realize pretty quick, we have maybe 100 employees on any given day that are working there at that hotel, and then a lot of guests. But the employees are who I interact with. This is not a condemning kind of statement. It's just a perspective. I would have been leading the pack on this years ago, by the way, but they're foul.
Right.
Their every thought is foul. And I say every thought. I mean, that atmosphere permeates what's going on at work. Everybody can tell you who the good-looking girls are, who they aren't. Everybody knows what they're wearing and so on. It's right on the surface of what everybody's thinking all the time. And there's ways you can jest about that, and there's fine lines between when that jest becomes sexual harassment. I've been there maybe 10 months now. We've already fired a couple people for sexual harassment just off our little department.
Wow.
I mean, you can't do that, but everybody's doing it. Okay, some people are just doing it in a way that's too aggressive, and you can't do that. But a lot of people are joking about that all the time. and so on. Okay, so you imagine human nature hasn't changed. You imagine 2 million people in close proximity every day, and they're moving forward through this. You know, the wilderness isn't going to provide them any distraction. So they're looking at each other. So you imagine what's going to happen. Okay, now let's put on top of that scenario, there's one glaring thing we would notice, again, as we look down that valley, that there's this big tent in the middle of this group. Mm-hmm. There's a pillar of cloud by day, fire by night, and you'd be going, now that's different.
Yeah, I haven't seen that before.
Okay. Well, there's some ramifications, like the book of Leviticus details of God being in your midst. Aaron's sons learned that the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But there are some ramifications for how you behave when God's there. So this chapter, chapter 5 of Numbers, is really concerned with the subject of purity. And that is a non-discussed subject in our culture. There's nothing that's pure in our culture.
Mm-mm.
None of us really even feel pure. We all feel, I mean, our sins are washed away by the blood of Christ. You know, amen. But we get dirty every day.
Well, and
just living in this world, you're getting dirty.
It kind of goes back to the 70s, Bob. You know, if it feels good, do it. Mm-hmm. Mentality. You know, and I know we talked
That's
about
right.
that in church at one point. I can't remember if it was a Truth Project deal or, but I remember we talked about that. You know, and I'm going to use this word loosely, but the evolution of man. You know, not in the way mm-hmm. that most people think
yeah.
it, but the evolution of man that we talked about. You know, along those lines.
Yeah. So, and it's not just sexual purity here. There are other things, though it's going to get around to that in this chapter, but there are other things. So I'm just setting the table, okay? So let's read the chapter. Numbers chapter 5. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the sons of Israel that they send away from their camp every leper, everyone having a discharge, everyone who's unclean because of a dead person. You shall send away both male and female. You shall send them outside the camp so that they will not defile their camp where I dwell in their midst. The sons of Israel did so, sent them outside the camp, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses. Thus the sons of Israel did. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel. Let's pause for a second before we get into verse 6 and following. Remember how we've laid out this book in at the beginning of this podcast and the beginning of chapter 1 last week. You have 2 million plus people here, and none of them survive the wilderness except for 2. That's a lot of death.
Mm-hmm.
You have 2 million people dying in the next 40 years, and you can't have that in God's presence. Right? You
right.
can't be anywhere. So this is a major concern, that they're going to be having death in the camp, and you can't have that when he's there. That's defilement. So it looks like, yeah, we just read a couple of verses. Oh, okay. Those are very big as far as their practicality of the mechanics of moving forward through this time.
Right.
Okay, so verse 6. Speak to the sons of Israel. When a man or woman commits any of the sins of mankind... That's a perfect way to say it, right? Acting unfaithfully against the Lord, and that person is guilty. Then he shall confess his sins which he has committed, and he shall make restitution in full for his wrong, and add to it 1/5 to it, and give it to him whom he has wronged. In other words, you stole something from somebody, or you got in a fight, broke the guy's arm, or whatever it is.
Got to fix it.
Look at this, first of all, though, at the end of verse 6, and you acted unfaithfully against the Lord when you hurt someone else. That's interesting.
The
we think it's just against that guy. that's against the Lord when you mistreat someone, whether you steal from them or whatever. You're stealing from God, or you're hurting God's person. Or
well, and to really take it, you know, the full context, I mean, it goes back to the beginning of Genesis. Man was created mm-hmm. in God's image. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to treat his image, am I on the right trail?
That's exactly right. It's the whole basis for real law, that a person is the image of God. You can't harm that.
Right.
Whether you're stealing from him or ripping him off, you know, however, you cannot do that. That's the image of God. So you're right. So, verse 7, then he shall confess his sins which he has committed. He shall make restitution in full for his wrong, add to it one-fifth of it, and give it to him whom he has wronged. But if the man has no relative to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, say he did a wrong, and now the guy's dead, you know, how are you going to, he's dead, well, pay the relative. And, well, if there's no relative, they're just going through a bunch of contingencies. The restitution which is made for the wrong must go to the Lord for the priest, besides the ram of atonement, by which atonement is made for him. Also, every contribution pertaining to all the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they offer to the priests, shall be his. So every man's holy gifts shall be his. Whatever any man gives to the priest, it becomes his. It's the priest's. Right? Because you're giving it to the Lord. The priest represents the Lord. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, if any man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, and a man has intercourse with her, and it's hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she's undetected, although she has defiled herself, and there's no witness against her, and she has not been caught in the act, if a spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife when she has defiled herself, or if a spirit of jealousy comes over him and he's jealous of his wife when she has not defiled herself, the man shall then bring his wife to the priest, shall bring as an offering for her one-tenth of an ephah of barley meal. He shall not pour oil on it, nor put frankincense on it, for it's a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of memorial, a reminder of iniquity. Then the priest shall bring her near, have her stand before the Lord. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel, and he shall take some of the dust that's on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. The priest shall then have the woman stand before the Lord and let the hair of the woman's head go loose, place the grain offering of memorial in her hands, which is the grain offering of jealousy, and in the hand of the priest is to be the water of bitterness that brings a curse. The priest shall have her take an oath and shall say to the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone astray into uncleanness, being under the authority of your husband, be immune to this water of bitterness that brings a curse. If you, however, have gone astray, being under the authority of your husband, and if you have defiled yourself, and a man other than your husband has had intercourse with you, then the priest shall have the woman swear with the oath of the curse. And the priest shall say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people, by the Lord's making your thigh waste away, and your abdomen swell. And this water that brings a curse shall go into your stomach, make your abdomen swell, and your thigh waste away. The woman shall say, amen, amen. The priest shall then write these curses on a scroll. He shall wash them off into the water of bitterness. Then he shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings a curse, so that the water which brings a curse will go into her and cause bitterness. The priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy from the woman's hand. He shall wave the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar. And the priest shall take a handful of the grain offering as its memorial offering, and offer it up in smoke on the altar. And afterward he shall make the woman drink the water. And when he has made her drink the water, then it shall come about, if she has defiled herself and has been unfaithful to her husband, and the water which brings a curse shall go into her and cause bitterness, and her abdomen will swell, and her thigh will waste away, and the woman will become a curse among her people. But If the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, she will then be free and conceive children. This is the law of jealousy, when a wife, being under the authority of her husband, goes astray and defiles herself. When a spirit of jealousy comes over a man, he's jealous of his wife, he shall then make the woman stand before the Lord. The priest shall apply all this law to her. Moreover, the man shall be free from guilt, but that woman shall bear her guilt. There's chapter 5. A lot of detail on that.
I have, maybe a dumb question, Bob, but so it really details this out for the wife in particular.
Yeah.
Is that because at this time in the culture it was accepted for a man to have more than one wife, and the real onus for the relationship is on the wife?
You know, this is one of those questions where, and I, you know, you will understand this better, but I offer this for all our listeners. I don't know. I don't know. Because I'm reading this going, man, if this guy accuses his wife of something and he's wrong, there's no nothing. He just walks away. And her name is cleared.
Right.
But, man, you're accusing her of something she didn't do. You know, I don't like the sound of that.
Right.
So then, like you're suggesting, you would dig into the culture of the day, and your point's a good one. It was not uncommon for a guy to have more than one wife. Though it was not common, it wasn't uncommon. You know what I mean? There's a lot of, we're not talking 50% this, 50% that. It's child rearing families in their day was much different. You know, modern medicine, they don't have that. Many people die in childbirth, and you know, if you can't get pregnant, you get another wife and so on. Though it's not like you divorce the first one. So there's, and if your brother dies and he doesn't have children yet, you take her as your wife. So there are cultural things that are very different from today. But even given those things, I still don't know how that explains what's going on here.
Well, it's really difficult. And I mean, as we're talking about it, I can't think of one example in the entire text that talks about a woman who had multiple husbands. But I can think of many examples that talk about a husband that had multiple.
Okay, so let's, in one sense, try to come to grips with it, because I know, Jamie, you have a particular burden. Say we challenge a person at the bus stop, you know, today, hey, we want you to read this. And they get to this part. Let's say it's a girl.
Mm-hmm.
It's a friend, co-worker of ours, or a friend that you meet. Hey, and they read this and they go, you know, I'm not really that interested in being a part of something like that. Well, we live in a New Testament time, for one thing. But I still understand the concern someone would have. It's, in a sense, it registers to me as simply stated, that's not fair. What about if the guy sleeps around? How come there's not a law for that? How come he doesn't have to drink the dusty water with the word, you know? How come his thigh doesn't waste away? And so, right. You know, it doesn't. So the way to say it is, it doesn't sound fair. So, again, let me reiterate something and then try to have a theological approach to it. One, I don't know. I don't know their culture well enough to understand the ins and outs of something like that. But I confess that not because I'm lazy. I mean, I've read as much as I can on this. I don't know. I don't know what we're dealing with here. I don't know the gist of these laws. I can tell you, however, that if you read Babylonian law, Egyptian, very similar on those kinds of issues. So, number one, it's a patriarchal society. Israel's moving towards kingship, not queenship.
Well,
right?
It's been patriarchal since Adam.
Yeah, you know? it's a patriarchal. Well, you know, it's male leadership. So I'm not excusing the text, and I've never once in my life felt like compelled to defend God. I mean, this is coming from him. So I say, okay, I just simply confess that I really don't understand it at that level. My guess is the way it worked out was, I think there would be repercussions for the guy. I don't think you, even though there's no, oh, chapter 6 is all about the guy's penalties, you know, anybody who's married, you don't want to be accusing your wife of something. Then she goes to the temple and, honey, guess what?
I'm clean. I didn't get sick.
Yeah, I didn't get sick. You know, there's going to be some cold nights out there. That's not to make light of this. I'm just saying how it probably worked out in their culture did have a balance to it. But I do want to say one other thing that needs to be thought through by every person. Spend some time, maybe a week, a month, a year, 10 years studying history. And whenever the Bible has been introduced to a culture, there's never been anything as powerful as this book as far as elevating the role of women in a culture.
Sure.
Ever. The very earliest verse that comes into play is Genesis 1:26-28. In the image of God, he made them male and female. Because you had a bunch of cultures back then that, no. You know, the guy's in charge. And you have the Bible going, you know, that woman is the image of God as well. Mm-hmm. And we'll see prophetesses in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
We will see the role of women advanced beyond what any other thing has ever advanced them in any culture. And if you don't believe me, do the history work. The Bible sets women free. And I'm not using that to explain this chapter. It strikes me the same way. Hey, this is kind of one-sided. You know, what about the woman's rights and so on? I'm just saying, in the sweep of history, women and men are equal as God's image. And when you introduce the Bible, women's roles are elevated. But I don't get the historical nature of that.
I think there's a sort of almost disclaimer if we go back to chapter 5, verse 5. The Lord said to Moses, say to the Israelites, when a man or woman wrongs another in any way.
Yeah, there so it's that, very equal. That's right. And you read the book of Proverbs. That's a very good observation, Jamie. But also, you read the book of Proverbs, and it'll say, hey, your mother taught you this. Mm-hmm. Your father, it holds the mother and father equal as far as teaching and raising the children. You know, it's interesting. But the overall flavor of that chapter sort of weirds me out. But you'll see other chapters that take things differently and so on. So that's for each person to come to grips with as they see fit. You know how I can summarize it, though, and do this confidently? Any issue that you have, Jamie, or I have, or Jack is here with us tonight listening in, take that to God.
Sure.
Literally sit there with him and go, hey, this doesn't look fair to me. Hey, all I can say is, I promise he'll let you know. He's the most fair person you could ever imagine. He's not about oppressing women in any sense. He's about saving them.
Right.
So my encouragement to ourselves and our listeners is, if you have a real concern, take it to God. Sit there and in the chair with him and, you know, look back over your shoulder with a puzzled frown and go, what's that? What is the deal?
Right.
And he'll tell you.
It's all about the relationship is really, you know, the overwhelming message that I get. You know, not only the relationship as we go back to Leviticus talking about our relationship with God our Father, but also here, you know, if we're talking about the relationship between a man and a wife.
Yeah, and we just did the wedding for your son.
Mm-hmm.
What, a month ago?
Mm-hmm.
James got married. I mean, we read Ephesians about that. What is James's job description for Kendra. Does this sound oppressive?
No.
Love her as yourself. That sounds pretty freeing. Mm-hmm. Like, the husband's responsibility is to love the wife just as Christ loved the, you know, self-sacrificially love her. That's the ultimate biblical goal.
Right.
So, you know, you got to read the whole story.
Yeah. You can't just take a chapter like this and develop a steadfast, not only opinion, but you know, perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And I confess to our listeners, it weirds me out just like it does you.
Mm-hmm.
I just am, you know, at a place in life where I'm comfortable with God. I don't know. He's always... I see no reason to question him. You know, let's wrap up this way, because in one sense we're out of time, but we've covered, hey listeners, four chapters, man. That's pretty good.
We're making progress.
So we made a lot of progress, but I want to paint a scenario that'll help conceptualize a relationship with God. Kathy and I have been married, though I hate some of these details, I don't know, 16, 17 years, 96, 16. Okay, in this September, it'll be 16 years. We know each other much better than we did when we got married.
Mm-hmm.
And if I came home one day, unexpectedly from work, you know, oh, Bob, when you coming home? Oh, 6 o'clock tonight, but I came home at noon. And my wife works her fanny off. So, but imagine if she was not at work, right, running her shop. She was at home. I come home and there's a guy coming out of our house. And he's like disrobed. Maybe not completely naked, but, you know, comes running out of our house and I'm watching this. As strange as it might seem, I guarantee you I would not conclude. I think she's running around. I know her. My first thoughts would be, I mean, does this guy need help? Does she need help? What? It would not be that she's an adulteress. That is, it's not her. And I understand human nature and we're all fallen. At over 16 years, I know her.
Mm-hmm.
So, over many years of walking with God, you begin to know him. And when you read a passage like this, though on the surface you go, man, that's a guy in his underwear running out of my house. Underneath, you're going, but I know him, and he's not sexist. You know what I mean? He wouldn't just have a rule for women that he doesn't have for... That's not the issue that's going on. And all I can say is, that's how it works. I don't have specifics to spell that out. It's just a gut-level relationship thing that over time you develop with the Lord, that he's always proven himself to be completely just and righteous to every human being, right? Male and female. So that doesn't necessarily help with the passage, you know, if it's your first time through, and it will over time. It'll make sense. So let's say a prayer. Lord, we thank you for your never-ending faithfulness to us. And we pray that as we make our way through your words and struggle over certain passages, that you would reward that struggle, that you would prove yourself to be trustworthy, faithful, true, that you would comfort our hearts, that you would turn the pages in front of us, continue to explain your words, that we might see the world.